From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to the world's most listened to late night talk show, Coast to Coast AM. We've got a very busy night tonight, so let's get right into it. In Oklahoma, legislation that would authorize microchip implants in people convicted of violent crimes was sent back to a committee. This after the Oklahoma State House members questioned whether the proposal would violate constitutional civil liberties. The measure approved by the state Senate authorizes microchip implants for persons convicted of one or more of 19 violent offenses who have to serve at least 85% of their sentence. The tiny electronic implants are commonly used to keep track of pets and livestock, but several House members questioned whether their forced use in people would be unconstitutionally invasive. A man with a very rare and dangerous form of tuberculosis may have spread this disease to passengers and crew on two transatlantic flights to Paris and from Prague earlier this month. CDC officials released information about the passenger and called for people who were on the same flights to get checked for infection. What is unusual is that the patient's TB is extremely resistant to TB drugs, says the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The infected patient flew from Atlanta to Paris on May 12th, arriving on May 13th on Air France Flight 385. He returned to the United States on May 24th on Czech Air Flight 410 from Prague to Montreal. The man then drove into the United States. He is hospitalized in respiratory isolation, according to the World Health Organization. I talked with a friend of mine this weekend whose brother is a very important doctor in New York. And he says this very rare strain of TB seems to be growing. It is getting more and more widespread. There is no treatment. While Americans are still recovering from a scandal over poisoned pet foods imported from China, FDA inspectors report tainted food imports intended for American humans are being rejected with increasing frequency because they are filthy, contaminated with pesticides, and tainted with carcinogens, bacteria, and banned drugs. Last month, like most months, China topped the list of countries whose products were refused by the FDA. Some 257 refusals of Chinese products were recorded in April. By comparison, only 140 were from Mexico and only 23 from Canada. The disgraced head of China's Food and Drug Agency was sentenced to death amid a wave of consumer safety scandals that have rippled across the world, including what we just mentioned. He was found guilty of accepting $850,000 worth of bribes from pharmaceutical companies to expedite the approval of new drugs, underscoring the state's determination to crack down on corruption and consumer safety violations. He is the most senior official to receive the death penalty in 7 years in China. An American member of Al-Qaeda has warned President Bush to end U.S. involvement in all Muslim lands or face an attack worse than the 9/11 suicide assault, according to a new videotape. Wearing a white robe and a turban, Adam Gadan of California said Al-Qaeda would not negotiate on its demands. It was a seven-minute videotape. He's been charged, by the way, here in the United States with treason. He is the first American to be charged with treason in more than 50 years. Could face the death penalty if they find him and convict him. Russia has test-launched a new intercontinental ballistic missile capable of carrying multiple independent warheads. And a top Russian said it could penetrate any defense system. Well, the Vietnam War apparently ended April 30th, 1975, when American POWs came home, or did it? In a moment, we are going to investigate something that many of us from this era always questioned. Did we get all the POWs back home? That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And I think, you know, after you hear tonight's special program on POWs, we should have sent John Rambo to Vietnam many years ago. He could have gotten this job done, because what you are going to hear tonight is going to shock you. It even might make some of you very emotional, but it's something you need to hear. Former U.S. Representative Bill Hendon, a Republican out of North Carolina, served two terms on the U.S. House POW-MIA Task Force as a consultant on the POW-MIA affairs with an office in the Pentagon and as a full-time intelligence investigator assigned to the Senate Select Committee on POW-MIA affairs. He has traveled to South and Southeast Asia 33 times on behalf of America's POWs and MIAs. Hendon is considered the nation's foremost authority on intelligence relating to American POWs held after Operation Homecoming and an expert on the Vietnamese and Laotian prison systems. He, along with Elizabeth Stewart, and I'm going to introduce her in just a moment, have written an incredible story and book called An Enormous Crime. Congressman Bill Hendon. Hello, former representative. How are you, sir?
Fine, George. Thank you so much for your interest in these men. That we are convinced are still alive and in prison in Vietnam and Laos. And it's great to be on your show.
Well, I'm glad that we've got you and Elizabeth Stewart as well. Elizabeth Stewart's father, Colonel Peter J. Stewart, United States Air Force, missing in action in North Vietnam. His name appears on panel 6E. Line 12 of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. She has spent over two decades researching intelligence relating to American POWs and MIAs. Her efforts have taken her from Capitol Hill to Cambodia to the South China Sea to the presidential palace in Hanoi and to the most remote regions of North Vietnam. She's with us tonight, too. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Thank you for coming along with
this. Thank you,
and the
very
work,
much.
The work that you and Bill did in this book is absolutely staggering. I know it has just come out, and when I received a copy of your book, I jumped on this as I talked to our dear producers and staff here at Coast to Coast. And already, Alan Corbett was in touch with your publisher to get you on. So, as they say, great minds think alike. It's a very important story.
I spoke with Alan, and he's, like you, is very concerned about these men, like us, like a lot of Americans. But, you know, most people, George, as you mentioned earlier, they think when the war ended, well, as a matter of fact, our nation's leaders told us all the prisoners were home. But then came the boat people in the late 70s, and my goodness, a flood tide of intelligence that said, wait a minute. Your prisoners are still in prison. We've seen them. They've shouted to us to tell about their plight, you know, and here we are now washing ashore all over South, all over the Far East. And let us please tell you that your men are still alive. And these stories, these accounts, this intelligence, it's been pouring out and continues to be received by our government that the men are alive. So, by golly, we've got to do something, and we're very proud of this book that tells their story, not our story, not yours, theirs. And it's the first time that the plight of the men has really been laid out. And you see there in the book, it is laid out. if you read it, it's quite gut-wrenching, heart-rending stuff.
Oh, it really is. It tears you apart, but it's so necessary to read this, and it's so necessary for the follow-up, Bill and Elizabeth. You know, this conflict apparently ended 32 years ago, but we have many listeners who are of a young enough age where they don't really remember the Vietnam conflict. They don't remember how it was tearing this country apart. And my criticism, because I was in it right during my college days and then a little bit thereafter, my criticism of the protest groups of the time was not the protest war, because I think that's what we're all about. We have the right to do that. It was during that time period where they didn't support the troops. They didn't support the people who were over there giving their lives for this conflict, whether you agreed with it or not. And I hope through this Iraqi war that at least people have seen the difference now that you've got to support these American troops no matter what.
Well, one of the real tragedies here is that they talk support here in Washington, and yet when it comes to these men still in prison from the last war, they won't do anything and haven't done anything since 1973 to get them out. I take that back. Ronald Reagan, God bless him, he tried, and I know that because I helped, I was involved in working with him. He tried to get these men out in 1981 and 1982. And then his advisors all got around him and said, Mr. President, you're going to have another hostage crisis. You can't do this anymore. This is, it'll be like Jimmy Carter's presidency if we have. And it's a long story, and it's addressed in the book. But they got Reagan away from it. And those of us in Congress at the time, we kept saying, let Reagan be Reagan. Okay, let him do what his heart tells him to do. And yet they didn't, and the bureaucrats won out, and these men remain prisoner.
Let's go back just a little bit, Bill and Elizabeth, both of you jump in to tell us a little bit about the history of Vietnam. Of course, you know, it has been a region that has been in turmoil for so many years, and I don't know how many Americans truly understand that what was perceived to be the villain at the time of the war, Ho Chi Minh, was at one time a desperate American ally. He was propped up by the organization prior to what we call the CIA and begged, did he not, for American help and support before any of this happened?
Indeed he did, back in the 40s and early 50s. But when America, the Cold War was going on, and Ho Chi Minh, in the you know, later on, he went over into the communist camp, and America wouldn't have anything to do with him. But the opportunity in the mid and late 40s, he, as you said, George, correctly, he was begging America to be his ally.
He once said, Bill, and Elizabeth, I would welcome a million American troops here in Vietnam before we take one French person.
The French were extremely brutal, and the Vietnamese suffered terribly, both you know, in North and South Vietnam under the French rule. And you know, it's the Cold War intervened, if you will. And there was just no way that America could go to his aid because of the people around him, the things he was saying. It went communist, and we, of course, went the other way.
So this area, of course, that had Vietnam, it had North and South Vietnam, it had Cambodia, Laos, you know, started really during when the French occupied that region, and then the Eisenhower administration started to get us involved a little bit. And then tell us a little bit about Kennedy's involvement, and then LBJ.
Well, Kennedy, of course, when he went in 1961 as president, he and Johnson backed the South Vietnamese government both overtly and covertly. And the real story here, George, and we talk about it in the book, and pardon me for talking so much about the book, but I think that's what we're here to talk about.
Well, that's what you're here about, because it does uncover, I think, the root of this evil, and that was leaving those men behind.
That's right. Well, it all starts, the story starts at the Bay of Pigs, of all places, when Jack Kennedy and his brother Robert sent these freedom fighters. They were Cubans. They weren't Americans, but they were from, many of them lived in America. They sent the Cubans in there to overthrow Castro. And just at the critical point in the invasion, Kennedy backed away from providing air cover. The freedom fighters were overwhelmed. They were imprisoned. And ultimately, Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy paid like $50-60 million, which was a lot of money in 1962, to get these prisoners back. They had to buy them back, to ransom them back. And Fidel Castro went to the Vietnamese, and he of course was a blood brother of the Vietnamese, a fellow communist, and he told them, look, Kennedy, the Kennedy brothers paid for these prisoners. In your war with America, you capture as many Americans as you can, and at the end of the war, America will pay you to rebuild the war damage just like they paid us to rebuild the damage from the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Yep.
And that's where it all started, and the Vietnamese developed their own plan to use the prisoners in the same way. And that's what Henry Kissinger faced at the Paris Peace Accords. He negotiated an accord finally to end the war, and it was to pay the North Vietnamese $4,750,000,000 to rebuild their country in return for the prisoners. just like Castro had done at the Bay of Pigs.
So
here's what happened.
Okay, go ahead.
We got half the prisoners back at Operation Homecoming. And then they said, okay, where's our money? And just at that time, Watergate exploded in this town, Washington, and Nixon and Kissinger could not and did not pay the money to the Vietnamese. They kept the prisoners, and they've still got them.
Now, did we know at that time, did our administration know at that time that those prisoners were held back?
Absolutely, and we prove this beyond, pardon me, but we prove it beyond any doubt. For the first time, we show how the U.S. government knew and the fact that the U.S. government did know. And that's been one of the great mysteries, one of the great secrets of the Vietnam War. Did the U.S. government know? And anybody who, any objective analysis of what we present from the intelligence documents that we have uncovered at the National Archives and at the Library of Congress, we knew and we left them anyway.
Elizabeth, tell us how you got involved in this story.
Well, in 1966, when my father was shot down over Dien Bien Phu, I can recall that clearly when the Air Force came to the house, as they did, and told Mother that he was only missing and that everything that could be done was being done to find him. And it started with that. We certainly believed it. My mother, my five brothers and sisters, we were a very strong military Air Force family, and we believed what they told us. And it wasn't till sometime in the early 80s that I actually received an invitation to attend a government meeting with other family members in Washington, D.C. And I came, to be honest with you, George, I came because, one, I'd never been to D.C. before, and also because there were other family members there, and I thought it might be rather healing, if you will, to be around other family members. But instead of coming and consoling each other, what I learned from these other family members who had questioned and questioned and questioned their cases was that there were so many questions, the answers were not forthcoming, the information was not forthcoming. And it affected me so that 2 years later, I closed my law practice in Florida and moved to D.C. and stayed for 20 years, first to work on my father's case, and certainly that is the single most important case to me.
Of course.
But I approached it as my father would approach it, and that is that you care about America's military. And in his letter to me, I was 11 years old when I got it, he said, yes, I know you miss me and you care about me being here, but think of the others that serve with me. And that is the approach that I've taken for decades now. We looked for all of these men. It wasn't that I looked in intelligence reports repeatedly for Dad's name, though of course I would, but we looked at the intelligence on all of these men. And George, there is so much of it. And this book goes into it, dozens and dozens and dozens of stories that come out of Southeast Asia, telling of our men.
And when you two get into some of the satellite photographs of things that American soldiers have left as markers, just to notify us that they're out there, it's absolutely, tear came to my eye. It was shattering.
Georgia, as you know, on the cover of the book, and maybe when we go to break, some of your listeners can go to Amazon.com, not to buy the book, but to look at the cover. It's an enormous crime. Just pull it up, and you'll see there is a satellite image. It was taken in 1988 on the cover of the book, and it can only have been this image shows a code in a rice paddy only known to U.S. pilots. And this guy or guys put this thing down in a rice paddy in northern Laos in 1988. There have been other escape and evasion codes that the satellites have picked up well into the 1990s, where men are putting their names down, their secret codes, their secret authenticators, escape and evasion codes only they could know. And those codes all say, get me out of here.
Stay with us, Bill. We'll be back with you and Elizabeth Stewart in just a moment. You know, the average American soldier was 19 years old in Vietnam. So many of these individuals, I think, these 700, could still be alive. We'll be back in a moment with our two guests on Coast to Coast AM. Elizabeth, how old was your father when he was shot down?
George, my father fought in World War II. He was a career Air Force pilot.
Okay.
And he was 47 when he left to go to Vietnam. So he is a little older than those that you talked about.
Yes.
And certainly the majority, 18, 19 years old, no question, they could survive. In my father's case, to be honest with you, we don't know the answer. There has been information both negative and positive, so we don't know the answer. But as you said, these kids that went over there, 18, 19 years old.
Bill, we're going to get into the political problem of what happened and what we can do about it. We're going to be, you and Elizabeth will be with me for about 2.5 more hours. And
That's great.
In your last hour, we're going to open up the phone lines because I'm getting inundated from people who would just like to talk to both of you. So we'll do that in your last hour with me.
Thank you, sir.
In this situation, of the 700 that you believe might have been held back, how many do you really think might still be alive?
Oh, there's 500, 600. Look, the Vietnamese, and this, our information is from intelligence reports, and it's not, we didn't pull it out of the thin air, or it's not our opinion. The volume of the intelligence is absolutely staggering. And when I say intelligence, this is human intelligence where a guy or a woman or saw an American prisoner or a group of American prisoners, became a refugee, if you will, escaped from Vietnam or Laos, and told U.S. officials what he or she had seen. It might be a radio intercept where the communists are talking about the American prisoners, moving them from one place to another, when they're going to be moved, what time the airplane carrying the Americans will arrive. I mean, it's amazing. And these satellite images, like the one on the cover, with the men's names along in fields or trails, along trails, the volume of the intelligence, the specificity of the intelligence, the credibility of the intelligence is just overwhelming. And perhaps the best intelligence document, single piece of intelligence that was ever received, was received in 1993 when a Harvard researcher, and we talk about this in the book, he found the document in Leonid Brezhnev's files in the Soviet Union, top secret stuff, where the Soviets had a report that they had bugged a Politburo meeting in Hanoi, where the Vietnamese were acknowledging among themselves that they were holding over 1,200 prisoners in late 1972, and we got back 577.
Oh, man.
And the intelligence just indicates that hundreds were held back, and hundreds are still alive. They are keeping them alive because they have value, and they're kept for ransom, they're kept for reparations, for war damages. The Vietnamese have been very clear about it. America won't pay. They won't give them back.
Well, now, let me ask you this. What is preventing the Vietnamese, their government, from holding some international news conference with 5 or 6 POWs behind them saying, look, you know, this was our deal. We want reparations, and we've got them, and we've held them. Why won't they go public with that?
They're afraid. Of course, they're stuck with these guys, okay? They don't know what the heck to do with them. but they haven't killed them. There is no intelligence that indicates that they've either blown up their underground prisons where the Americans are being held with the Americans in them and killed them, or let them starve to death or die from disease. They continue to hold these men, and they have held many news conferences, except the Americans weren't there. And we talk about this in the book, where they have begged us, and sent offers to the American government privately to sell them back. The last offer we know of for sure was in 1981, where they sent an offer, hey, we will sell them back for X amount of money.
And well, why aren't
Again, we talk about this in the
Look,
book.
We just got $100 billion approved for Iraq.
Right.
Why can't we get these POWs back and write a check?
I'll tell you something, George, and we propose this in the book. We propose that President George W. Bush appoint the highest level, most powerful, most knowledgeable commission ever appointed, and send them right now, next week, to Vietnam and Laos with instructions to stay and negotiate until we gain these men's release.
Yes.
And if he will do that, his numbers in the polls will not go in the tank. They will go through the roof.
I think you're absolutely right, Bill. Is he fully aware of this situation?
It's interesting you would ask that. You know the veterans that came to town this past weekend with Rolling Thunder, the motorcycle guys?
Yes.
The Vietnam vets? A huge group of proud men. They went down, their leaders went down to the White House on Sunday and took a copy of the book that you have there in your hand and gave it to the President of the United States. And he said he would read it. Now, that's what the leader of the Vietnam vets told me. I don't know, but that's what he said happened, and I believe him, and I'm certain that the president has a copy of this book. And I feel better for these men that he does, because he's an honorable man, and he's having a terrible time right now with this war in Iraq. But, hey, let's fix this thing in Vietnam, and that'll help him fix Iraq. We believe that.
Well, this country, first of all, needs something good to hold on to. And getting these POWs back may be one of the best things for this country right now.
You know, George, you mentioned holding a news conference and having some of the POWs in the background. They, of course, haven't done that. But what they have done, and repeatedly, is continuously link the war reparations that Bill spoke about with Article 21 of the Paris Peace Accords with the promise by the Viets to search for America's missing, and that was Article 8B of the Accords, and they have continuously, repeatedly asked for those reparations and connected that again with the promise to search for America's missing. They have been linked. They've done it for 30 years. So no, they haven't held the news conference you described, but they've done the next best thing.
Well, let's hope that this program jumpstarts your efforts in your story here, an enormous crime, to get some of the mainstream media behind you.
Well, you know, George, it's amazing. You think this is 2007. That ought to be a story about Vietnam, ought to be in the history books. It's not. It's current events, because these men are still alive. And, you know, we went to war in Iraq on flawed intelligence, embarrassing for our country, embarrassing for our country's leaders, and what a shame. And it's going to be tough for our country to resolve this thing in an honorable way.
Yes.
It's just awful. But if we'll just look at the intelligence in Vietnam and not try to prejudge it, not say it says something that it doesn't, just go with the intelligence. And what the intelligence says is that our men are there. They want to come home. They are not deserters. They are not collaborators. They don't have wives. They're in prison, and they're being held for ransom. Maybe America has gotten to the point where it can address that now. I pray.
So they're not living with the Vietnamese. They're not enjoying themselves, are they?
These guys are going through hell on earth. And if you read these intelligence reports that are in the book, just the ones in the book, and there are only probably maybe 40, 50, 60 that we address an awful lot more on our website, which will be up at the end of the week. But my goodness, when a group of Vietnamese are walking along a country road. They come upon some guards and some American prisoners in slave labor carrying logs, and the Americans start hollering, "Please tell the world about us. Please go back to Saigon and tell that we're here. We're still held captive. Please tell the UN. Please tell the U.S. government."
But George, America did nothing. Our government did nothing in response.
All of them. All the administrations did nothing.
Actually, absolutely. Ronald Reagan, to his credit, and I know this because I worked with him on it, Ronald Reagan tried very hard early on in his first term to get these men home.
Well, why didn't it work? Where did he fall short, Bill?
His advisors would not let him be Reagan. Okay? We had a chant when we were in Congress back in the early 80s, we Republicans. It was, "Let Reagan be Reagan." Whether it was tax cuts or a strong national defense or any of the things that we all stood for. And in this case, Reagan, his heart was with these men, and he was willing to take some chances. Hey, he took some chances in the Iran-Contra affair just to get a handful of guys out.
If somebody stuck a microphone in Henry Kissinger's face, what would he say when asked the question about these POWs?
Hey, I frankly, pardon me for being, this is not intended to be flippant or smart. I don't really care what Secretary Kissinger says. What I say to Secretary Kissinger is, "Mr. Secretary, with great respect, I say, get on the plane and go over there and don't come home until you get the men back.
Finish what you started."
Yes.
Man. Well, I tell you, whatever we can do here on a program that reaches so many millions of people, you have our support, Bill.
Well, you're doing it right now, George.
Thank you.
We're very grateful.
You know, I do. I think back to the days when I was in college, you know, and I saw what had happened, you know, you witnessed the disaster at Kent State and the protests and the splitting down of this country to people who were not alive then or who were just little kids. They don't realize that this country was splitting apart during this time period.
It certainly was. And it was a difficult situation for Kissinger and President Nixon. We certainly don't avoid that fact, okay? Because the Vietnamese insisted, "You're going to pay us $4,750,000,000, or we're not going to quit fighting."
How did they get up to that price? Were they just?
We outlined that from declassified documents and from declassified North Vietnamese documents in the book. It's a fascinating story. But they learned it from Castro in 1962.
So they just put a number on each POW, I guess, right?
Oh, they say they're worth 2 to 3 factories, so we keep them alive. They are a living gold mine. I mean, and again, I'm not trying to sell the book, but the stories about that are in the book, and they are fascinating, and yet they are just tragic.
Are they still holding them, Bill, because they think they're going to get paid for them, or are they so embarrassed that they still have them, they're caught in a catch-22?
They're in a catch-22. They're stuck with them. They held them back for ransom. America committed to the ransom, okay, and got half of its prisoners back at Operation Homecoming. We, in the Paris Peace Accords and in a secret letter, which is addressed in the book, from Nixon to the leader of North Vietnam, we pledged to pay reparations, $4,750,000,000, without any political conditions. The Vietnamese said, "We want Secretary Kissinger," or in this case, National Security Advisor Kissinger, "we insist that he come to Hanoi and pledge that personally."
Mm-hmm.
Kissinger flew over there before Operation Homecoming began and committed to the North Vietnamese, "We will pay this money." They said, "Fine, here's half your guys. Now, where's the money?" And Kissinger said, "Sorry, guys, there isn't any." And they said, "Okay, what about these guys?" And those guys they're talking about, 700, 600, I'm not sure how many are still alive, and I'm not sure now, although I have been all over North Vietnam, visited many prisons, Beth has also, nobody's sure where they are. Well, wrong. The North Vietnamese are sure where they are, and that's all that matters. The North Vietnamese know where these men are right now, and the Pathet Lao know where they are right now. And we can't rescue them, but we can resolve it through negotiations and try to make this thing right. And can you imagine what it would do for George Bush Jr. if these men under his watch were saved?
I'm telling you, if look at this scenario, Bill and Elizabeth, that one, he gets back these remaining POWs, whether it's one or 700.
Absolutely.
It really doesn't matter anymore. You want them all.
Yep.
And we find bin Laden about a month later.
I vote for both of those.
I mean, just absolutely staggering. Well, I want to, as we get into next hour, talk about some of the ramifications behind this and why we really aren't doing anything right now.
Well, we may, because this president has this book. We know that from the vets.
But I can't believe this. Look, it's a great book. You two have done a great job. But I can't believe the president of the United States finds out about missing POWs from a book.
Nor can I, but that's the way Washington, D.C. works. Hey, go back to 81. Let Reagan be Reagan, we used to scream from the back bench in Congress.
Maybe, is it possible, we as a government just don't want them back?
I can't believe that. But there are many indications within the bureaucracy here, and they're outlined in the book, some of the things that some of our leaders and some of our analysts and some of our military officers have done to these men is criminal, beyond criminal. It's an enormous crime in itself.
Can you imagine the letdown when these 700 thought that in 1975 they were going to all come home?
Hey, how about this? How about going out and putting your name down, exposing yourself to your captors, perhaps, putting your name down in a prison yard, praying that the satellites pick it up, and they do. On the 5th of June, 1992, there's a guy's name in the prison yard in North Vietnam, right outside of prison, where we've had many reports of Americans held. His name is in the prison yard. They look at the missing list, and he's missing.
Do you blame the Vietnamese for holding back 700 because of the promise to give them this $4-plus billion?
The Vietnamese have a point, okay? But blaming people right now, it isn't, pardon me, George, but what's important is that we all sit down and somehow get this thing resolved and get those men out of there. It'd be good for Vietnam, it'd be good for Laos, and it'd be good for America. Most people believe here in Washington it would be horrible for America. I don't agree. I don't know how you can look at this many reports of men in desperate straits and say it's good to leave them in desperate straits.
I can't remember, but I do recall the stories of people saying, we left POWs behind. And this was 30 years ago. How did those things get leaked out?
Well, I was part of it, I'm proud to say. I've been raising hell about this since 1981 when I first came to Congress. And a lot of my friends, former Congressman John Laboutelier, Bob Dornan right down the road from you there in California, Dana Rohrabacher, good night, Duncan Hunter, all those guys, they're patriots. And they have said, wait a minute, you know, we've got to do something about this.
All right, stay with us. Bill Hendon, Elizabeth Stewart, their book, An Enormous Crime. You are hearing part of it. More to come. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.